Welcome to the I Have ADHD podcast, where it's all about education, encouragement, and coaching for adults with ADHD. I'm your host, Kristen Carter, and I have ADHD. Let's chat about the frustrations, humor, and challenges of adulting, relationships, working, and achieving with this neurodevelopmental disorder. I'll help you understand your unique brain, unlock your potential, and move from point A to point B. Hey, what's up? This is Kristen Carter, and you are listening to the I Have ADHD podcast. I'm medicated. I'm caffeinated. I am regulated AF, and I am ready to roll. Let's go. Happy to have you with me here today. Thanks so much for pressing play on this podcast. You won't be disappointed, listener. I know you won't. You're not going to be disappointed because today I have a guest that you are not going to want to miss. His name is Lane Norton. You might know him as Bio Lane on Instagram or, you know, the socials. He's got a casual 1 million followers. So whatever, it's like not that big of a deal. But I'm happy to have him with me today. And I think that you are going to so resonate with his story of struggle and hardship and then eventual success. I hope that it's so inspiring for you. Lane is a self-proclaimed nerd who lifts heavy things. He comes with a hefty resume, including a PhD in nutritional sciences and also 4 USA powerlifting national titles, most recently winning gold at the 2023 Powerlifting America National Championships. Lane helped popularize flexible dieting and online nutrition coaching using evidence-based methods. And that is like, that is the point. Evidence-based methods. I love it so much. Coaching over 1,700 clients. He's got a coaching team. He's written books. He's got a nutrition coaching app, educational courses. The list goes on and on. You're going to want to tune into this episode today because he really talks about what it was like for him growing up with ADHD, how he experienced a lot of bullying, and how the most significant effect that ADHD has had on his life has been through his relationships. And we really get into all of that. I can't wait for you to hear from him. Please enjoy this episode with Lane Norton. Lane, thanks so much for being here. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Kristen. I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's really, really fun. I've been following you for a while and we'll get into this later, but I love watching you debunk a lot of like influencer nutritional kind of things. Every time I'm like cheering along with you, I love how fired up you get about the BS nonsense that's out there. It makes me so happy. And like I said, we'll get into that. That's not even the most interesting thing about you, but I know that you're diagnosed with ADHD. Do you mind telling me a little bit about your diagnosis story? Like, were you diagnosed as a kid or as an adult?
Yeah, so I come from a basically completely neurodivergent family. My brother was ADHD. I'm ADHD. My mom's ADHD. I would not be surprised if dad is either.
Yeah.
Really, my parents are great people, but it was a little bit chaotic, I guess. Each of our kind of symptoms manifested in a different way for each of us.
Yeah.
So I got diagnosed when I was 6 years old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so very early. I was very lucky because my grandfather on my mom's side, I talk about him a lot, but he was like my personal hero. This guy, I don't want to go too far into it, but he was basically the funniest person I ever met, had an amazing heart, and was also a legitimate war hero. Like just a
wow,
most ethical person I ever met. And he started and was president of the Southwest Indiana Children's Mental Health Society, I think it was called. And this is like the late 60s, early 70s. So he was thinking about children's mental health back when, you know, it was basically suck it up and stop whining, right? They don't do what you tell them, just hit them a little harder.
Yeah, totally.
And so when I was having some trouble in school, I never got bad grades. I was always pretty smart, but I had a real problem paying attention and stuff I wasn't interested in, speaking out of turn. I'm very impulsive in conversation. That is something I've had to work really hard to get under control. And even my friends at times, like I actually was just having a text conversation with my best friend about that. He's like, hey, I have seen that like you have done a better job of catching yourself on this, which is great. People who don't know you, like, he's like, I know that you're just a big kid and you know, there's nothing nasty behind it. You care about other people's opinions. You're just so excited to share everything. So my mom kind of noticed me struggle with that. And then I think actually my ADHD manifested in a more difficult way for me in personal relationships. So I was struggling with like kind of making and keeping friends, and I got bullied a lot growing up. And so she actually got me diagnosed at age 6. And this was when, you know, it was kind of like taboo to diagnose your kid with ADHD. I want to say it was in 1988 when this happened.
Okay.
22. So she immediately got me in to see a therapist, and I was on Ritalin, and both those things helped. People, I think because I'm in fitness, people expect me to be like very anti-medication. I'm like, no, I actually, so I took Ritalin until I was like 14 or 15, and then we switched to Adderall, and I felt like Adderall worked better for me. So school got easier for me the longer I went, because I got more into stuff that I was interested in. So I had like a 3.5. So I'm on the 4.0 grading scale. And by the way, all you kids listening out there, the actual 4.0 grading scale, not this knocked out thing they got. These. I had a 3.5, so A average in high school. And then in college, I got like a 3.6. And then in graduate school, I was like a 3.9. Because it was just getting stuff I was more and more interested in.
Can I ask, were you treated the whole time, medically treated for ADHD the whole time?
So I stopped taking Adderall, I would say like 2 years into grad school. Because I just.
So you still got a 3.9.
Yeah. And I just felt like at that point, this is stuff I can hyperfixate on. You know.
Sure. Yeah. Like your special interest anyway.
Yeah. I thought I had a lot going on. I guess I did for most graduate students, but it was not much for me. Like looking back. So like I was started my coaching business when I was in graduate school, started taking on people online. I was competing in bodybuilding, but that was pretty much it. And I am grateful. Like I met my first wife when I was 22, and we were together for almost, I want to say 12 years, 13 years. And I think, again, personal relationship struggles. If I had been like trying to find a person back then, because I was always afraid of being by myself, that would have sucked up so much of my time energy. So it was actually great that like I had this like, steady relationship. Was, you know, pretty good for the most part for, you know, that period of time. You know, that enabled me to really focus in on lifting, coaching, and doing grad school. And some people will say ADHD is a superpower. Some people will say it's not. For me, it just depends on what I'm working on. Like I can do, you know, the stuff I'm good at, I can do it. What it takes to other people 6 hours to do, I can do in an hour or two. So I took Adderall until 25, and I went off of it for about 15 years because, again, I felt like I had good study habits. But as I got further along, and then I had two kids who were both neurodivergent. My son is nonverbal autistic. My daughter is basically my clone. Like, I'll get so upset with her about certain stuff, and then I'll be like, oh, my God, this is my God.
It's me. That's karma, by the way.
Yeah. No, she's the funniest, most loving human being I've ever met.
That's awesome.
She also drives me insane, of course.
Of course.
So having that and then like have pieces or all of four different businesses and I'm doing content and I'm still trying to compete as an athlete, it just got to the point where I felt like I'm plugging holes in a dam. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so about 2 years ago, I decided, you know, it probably makes sense for me to, you know, try and get some more help with this. And so the things that really helped was I got back on Adderall, and I also have, I think I've kind of figured out my system, which is I am a really creative person. I'm really good on video. I'm really good at talking, at doing interviews. I'm good at content. I'm good at writing, and I'm good at speaking to people. I can usually conversationally do pretty darn well. I have been able to develop my businesses where that's pretty much what I do. But I put people around me who are very, very attention to detail. And I describe them as like, I am a bowling ball barreling down the lane. And they are my bumpers. And they are going to shimmy me back into where I need to be as I go barreling down that lane. And so that's like one of my best friends is like the smartest business person I've ever met. Like he's like a business savant. I've never met anybody like him. And he is very high attention to detail. He's very regulated. He's methodical, which is not me, right? So we're like a great 1-2 combo because he puts the plan in place and then he just tells me how to go execute. And then my person who runs my coaching company, she is very high attention to detail. She's the kind of person where I can have the idea and she will go out and make it happen, right? And then my personal assistant is utterly amazing. I'm like, my personal assistant, Caroline, is my boss. when she first started, she's like, hey, I'm sorry I'm texting you about this stuff. If it's bothering you, I'm like, no. Text me. Remind me.
Yeah.
Like, hey, you had this.
This is literally what I pay you to do.
Right,
please.
Exactly. If I go somewhere and I forgot what my itinerary is and I text her and ask her, she never gets frustrated or whatever.
Yeah.
She knows that this is just kind of how I am. And part of, you know, part of working for Lane is you got to wrangle Lane. You know, we got to wrangle him in because he's up here in the clouds doing his thing. So having the person who does my videos, we'll be filming and I'll be like, hey, Brian, I just did this. Can we do this with it and put it in here? And you know, it's just like magic. I tell them what I want done and it happens. Being able to do that has freed me up to be more creative, to do podcasts like this, to do what I'm good at, which is basically talking on camera, doing content and writing. At this point, you know, I've gotten better with organizational stuff. Like I will actually look at my calendar now when the day starts, as opposed to previously, where it's just like, what are we doing today? You know, I guess I'll just go in and fire up some emails and see what happens, you know?
Right.
And having that team in place who has enabled me to do that has been huge. Now, I'm sure a lot of people listening be like, what did you do before you had this? Right?
Yeah.
I can only speak kind of as an entrepreneur, but I think the best first investment you can make is getting a good personal assistant because there is just some stuff that you're going to suck at. And
thank you so much because I have said that probably 150 times on this podcast and I can hear people roll their eyes at me. Like I can just hear collectively everybody being like, yeah, Kristen, like you're coming from a place of privilege. And like, of course, that would be so nice to have an assist. But I'm like, no, you don't understand. Like exactly what you said, somebody with ADHD, whether you are an entrepreneur or you're in corporate, but you can't manage your calendar. You can't do your emails. You can't get your shit together. Having a neurotypical, usually neurotypical, let's be honest, by your side, just being like, hey, here's what you need to do. Hey, here's the next thing. Hey, that thing doesn't matter. You need to stay focused on this. It allows you to flourish. So like, I am cheering. I'm sorry I interrupted you. I'm so excited that that's what you said. It's the best first investment, 100%.
Here's what would happen before I had an assistant. I would say yes to everything. I would do everything. And then I would not put stuff on my calendar. And somebody, hey, you didn't show up for the podcast. What? It was like, I make all these little cuts. And all of a sudden, by the time I felt that I was bleeding, I was gushing blood, right? And it manifested in some really poor decisions in business, cost me a lot. My point is, if I'd had good people around with me, and if I'd made good decisions and slowed down, this never would have happened. And one of the things that the people around me helped me do is slow down because I can work like crazy. Like I said, I can get a lot done in a short period of time until I get to that overloaded point and then I'm lashing out everywhere.
Yeah.
And so having people basically to just wrangle me has been huge.
Yeah.
And people can call it privilege. They can call it whatever they want. But here's the deal. If you're a business owner, you have to figure out what about you makes money, right? What about you is able to produce revenue? Before a personal assistant, I spent so much time chasing my tail with accounting and random emails and scheduling and all this different kind of stuff, right?
Yeah.
And once I got a personal assistant, I didn't have to do that anymore. Guess what I got to spend more time doing? The stuff that actually makes money. The stuff that actually drives the business. I think people think that businesses are a lot more fragile than they really are. Mm-hmm. Businesses really only fail for a few different reasons. Really bad decisions, really bad hires, being over leveraged and not adapting. Those are pretty much why they fail, right? So if you're in an industry that actually has legs, and I mean, yeah, like people will say, well, recessions and this and that, COVID, that's kind of a random thing. But again, that's kind of pivoting. And also, if you weren't over leveraged during a recession, it may be a little bit more painful, but you're not going to go out of here.
Right. You're going to be okay.
So I really do look at that as like the first place to spend money is getting somebody to help you out.
Oh, I love it. And now a word from our sponsor. Hey, Hey, Kristen here. I'm the host of this podcast, an ADHD expert and a certified life coach who's helped hundreds of adults with ADHD understand their unique brains and make real changes in their lives. If you're not sure what a life coach is, let me tell you. A life coach is someone who helps you achieve your goals, like a personal trainer for your life. A life coach is a guide who holds your hand along the way as you take baby step after baby step to accomplish the things that you want to accomplish. A good life coach is a trained expert who knows how to look at situations, all situations, with non-judgmental neutrality and offer you solutions that you've probably never even considered before. If you're being treated for your ADHD, and maybe even you've done some work in therapy, and you want to add to your scaffolding of support, you've got to join my group coaching program, Focused. Focused is where functional adults with ADHD surround each other with encouragement and support. And I lead the way with innovative and creative solutions to help you fully accept yourself, understand your ADHD, and create the life that you've always wanted to create, even with ADHD. Go to ihaveadhd.com/focused to join. And I hope to see you in our community today. Okay, so you mentioned that the way that you've seen ADHD manifest over the last four decades is primarily in your relationships. I mean, you see it in other areas, but what you seemed to express earlier was that, like, you see the detrimental effects of ADHD in personal relationships. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because we talk about relationships a lot around here. And I don't think people realize how much ADHD really does impact relationships. What's been your experience?
So I think there's a couple things. It's hard to disentangle the ADHD from my childhood bullying because that was pretty severe.
Yeah.
Like 12 years long and pretty intense. Mm. But I think probably some of the reasons I was bullied was because I was neurodivergent.
Yeah.
Like I was very loud, passionate, you know, excitable. And when you're young, that's not stuff that's, you know, quote unquote, cool. It's cool to act like you don't care about anything. And I cared about a lot of stuff. Mm. So I think in personal relationships, one of the ways I really saw it manifest, and I, even with friends and still to this day, it's very difficult for me. When somebody is like telling me like feedback, it is really hard for me not to. Criticism is something I really struggle with because it feels like bullying. Like, I know it's not the same. I know it's not the same.
Yeah.
But I have gotten some good people in my life. Like, my best friend is a great example. And actually, if I look back at the professors and teachers I had who I responded best to, they were exactly this profile, which is, when you do something right, I give you all the credit in the world and I gush over you. And when you do something wrong, I tell you I love you, but you screwed this up, right?
Yeah.
And my therapist has actually been that way too. I've been with her on and off for 8 years. She is not like your typical, she does things very differently. Like, she has cursed at me in session and been like, you effed that up, you know? Not like in an angry way, but just like,
sure,
you know.
She's a straight shooter.
So I have trouble taking feedback and criticism, especially if I feel like I take it better when the person also acknowledges what I'm doing right.
Yes.
Because otherwise, I've had this in relationships where it's mostly feedback and I understand the person's frustrated, but I get to the point where I feel like, man, I just don't do anything right. And when I get to that point, it gets hard for me to keep putting in the effort because it's like, even if I do it, I'm going to still get criticized. I did it the wrong way anyway, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's tough. And, you know, I think also the fact that I could be so spastic, you know, I could be like, super engaged with somebody like a friend of mine or whatever, and then all of a sudden they don't hear from me for like 4 weeks, right?
Oh, yeah.
It is not that I don't care, and if they reach out to me and they need something, I always respond quickly, but sometimes I'll forget to initiate. You know, sometimes I'll forget to follow up. You know, sometimes I'll be like putting together a guest list and I'll forget to invite somebody. I'm like, oh my God, this is one of like the people I care about most. How the hell did I forget this, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think people who don't know me real well or take things personally. I had this in a relationship too, where the person, they felt like I was leaving out details because I was trying to hide things. And the reality is I just forget random stuff. you know?
100%.
And yeah. It actually created a pretty big schism in the relationship because they got to the place where they were kind of like making the worst assumptions about me with kind of everything.
Yeah.
And then I started feeling super, you know, defensive and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, round we go.
Of course.
And so that's kind of like some of the stuff I struggle with where ADHD is kind of manifested for me. And actually my therapist was kind of like, you might need like somebody who is like very tuned up to this, you know, like maybe you need an ABA therapist or something like that, you know. You know, I think for me, I also taking responsibility for my own stuff, I just wasn't super aware of a lot of this stuff for a long time.
Yeah.
And to be fair, like, I think I probably wasn't, not for lack of trying, but I didn't know how to be a good friend. And definitely didn't know how to be a good partner, I mean, until a few years ago, you know, and there's still stuff I struggle with it. But I try to be more aware of my own stuff. I will catch myself starting to like butt into a conversation and I'll go, hang on, what I'm going to say is not nearly as important as making the person who's saying what they're saying feel heard. In fact, for a while on my phone, my screensaver was focus on understanding rather than being understood. Something of that nature, right? My therapist, she's very convinced that I'm autistic as well. And, you know, I have this thing of, no, if I could just get them to understand my point, if they could just understand. And it's like, you know, nobody can walk really in your shoes. You know, you're better off like kind of trying to bridge that gap by understanding the other person than trying to force them into understanding you. And so this is, you know, it's all stuff I've learned in the last few years. It really has been kind of like looking back, I'm like, oh, well, I see why that thing happened. I see why that happened. And
totally.
Just trying to be more self-aware of this because I just think for a long time, I thought I was pretty normal, you know? And then now I'm like, oh, yeah, makes sense why my friends say they need a nap after they're around me and stuff like that, you know? Like I'm a little much sometimes.
Totally. I so resonate with that. And I'm curious if you feel like you are headed in a good direction of having like connected friendships.
Oh, yeah.
That feel, you know, mutual. Yeah. Like, have you been able to apply what you've learned? And do you see your friendships kind of changing and evolving in a really good way?
Yeah, because I've done more of the stuff that's me, which is I'm a big personality. I'm going to be the center of attention. I'm going to be the life of the party, you know, all that kind of stuff. But also realizing like, hey, part of being like the life of the party or the life of the room is making other people feel good, right?
Totally.
And I honestly also think somebody I had that I dated for a while said this. I actually think it was a really good point. Like, you know, I think you actually, like, it was a good thing for you, but also a bad thing for you because you got into a space where you're like really well known and people want it, are very interested in what you have to say. So when you're meeting people for the first time, they have no problem letting you just tell stories and be big and loud, and they're completely enthralled with what you're saying. But as you get more into a personal relationship where the other person wants to be heard, whether it's friendship or a romantic relationship, now it's like I'm so used to like, oh, I can just tell my stuff, right?
Yeah.
Realizing that that's a really good way to alienate somebody, you know?
Totally. That one-sided thing only lasts so long.
Yeah. My second wife, I used to joke that I only had 5 stories and I just put them in a rotation because I'd be like telling her a story and she would be like, yeah, I've heard this one like 5 times, you know? And I'd be like, well, can't you just sit with it? You know, like maybe that's how better this time, you know? So
I love it. That's so great.
It's been challenging to become self-aware of this because I think I really struggle with like finding out I hurt people's feelings with definitely not ever intending to do that. But it's also been kind of liberating as to, okay, I'm going to try and work on this stuff and try and hear people. But I'm not going to try and like change the core of who I am because, you know, in terms of being the big personality and having a lot to say, because if somebody doesn't like that about me, then that's okay. They could be a great person, but they're not my people, you know?
Totally. Totally.
Yeah, that's kind of been.
I love that. I do want to transition here because you have accomplished so much. And I love having ADHDers on the podcast who are just like really successful and an example of what's possible for somebody with ADHD. What do you consider to be your biggest accomplishments? I mean, you're a world champion, you're a PhD. Like, what are your, for you, like, what are the things that you're most proud of?
My kids are alive. Yeah, oh, alive so far, you know?
It seems that is so happy, you know? Yeah. How old are your kids?
My daughter's 7 and my son's 10. So
okay, yeah.
I'm saying that tongue in cheek, but like,
but still, no small thing.
It's tough for me. It's very tough for me. I feel like I've only just, like, in the last few years, really stepped into it. There are still times I struggle. Like, nobody ever tells you how much shame there is around parenthood until you're a parent. I actually really like talking about this stuff because when my friends get pregnant, I'm like, congratulations. Now, I'm going to tell you the stuff that nobody is going to tell you. Here's what's going to happen, right? You're going to feel constantly guilty, feel like nothing's ever enough. And you're going to have other people make you feel that way because they're going to judge your decisions. Okay.
Yep.
So one of the things I've had to do more of, and I did this yesterday, was I was, house is a wreck. I'm feeling kind of overwhelmed. I'm like, hey guys, you know, and I know, like, I'm not a big fan of putting the kids on screens, but I'm like, hey, you guys, watch some TV. Dad's going to go outside for 30 minutes. I'm going to read a book, you know? And I just know, I'm like, I'm approaching my limit. I came from a household of yellers. I'm really trying to not yell at my kids. And I know when my limit is getting too high, you know? And so I stepped outside, read a book, and came back in and felt better. And, you know, we actually had a pretty good end of the day. And some people might look at me and go, you're not supposed to put your kids on screens, and you're not supposed to, like, just leave them inside. And I'm like, okay, I got to shoot the alligator closest to the boat right now. Because if I end up yelling at my kids for 5 minutes and it traumatizes them, or they're scared of dad, to me, that's worse than they just had some screen time. You know what I mean?
100%.
100%. I am proud of the fact that, you know, I've kind of stepped into being a dad more. On the career side of things, the PhD was very, very hard. It's funny because nutrition is kind of viewed as like a soft science by a lot of people. Huh. And I'm like, really? Because I took calculus-based physics. I took calculus 1 through 3. I took differential equations. I took instrumental chemistry. I took biochemistry. I took organic chemistry. I took analytical chemistry, took, you know, nutritional aspects of disease. I took nutritional biochemistry. Like, I took some hardcore, I took physical chemistry, which is a nightmare. I took some hardcore science classes. Okay. My bachelor's is in biochemistry. And I'm like, I did a PhD. What do you think I did for 6 years? Stare at the food guide pyramid? Because that's not what I did. I took very advanced courses, but the courses weren't the difficult part. The difficult part was the research. There's no, it's, you know, med school is hard. Absolutely. But if you take these tests and you pass these tests, you become a physician. As a research-based PhD, there's a guideline of timetable. But guess what? If your experiments don't work or you don't collect the data you need, you stay until you are finished, right? And for somebody with ADHD, that can be really hard too, because I can remember being far enough into the tunnel that I came in and I couldn't see light on the other side, right? And I actually, even though I was doing very well in school, my first few experiments, not only did they not work, I just couldn't even get the data collection stuff to work, because I don't think people have a full appreciation for how much of an insane attention to detail you need to get clean data.
Dang.
In vivo studies. So meaning like animals or humans or whatever. Physiology is very messy. Mm-hmm. And my first few studies, it was just all over. So my main outcome measurement that we're looking at was what's called muscle protein synthesis. So the rate at which you synthesize new muscle tissue. You're essentially looking at small differences between small numbers, and the analysis to get there are so many steps where you can screw up. It takes about a week to do an analysis on, say, like 20 to 40 samples. It's not like CSI. You know, they throw things in a centrifuge and all of a sudden randomly it spits back out data and it seems like they took 5 minutes doing it. This is a week-long process. And for about 2 years, we couldn't get it to work.
Dang.
And fortunately, I had another lab mate who he and I collaborated and worked together, and we figured out where the error in our process was. But after that point, I realized, okay, you know what? I'm not a high attention to detail guy, but I got to figure out a way to make this high attention to detail, because otherwise we are not getting out of here. But before that happened, before we figured it out, my PhD advisor had called me into his office about 2.5 years in. I had actually missed a meeting with my committee because I didn't put it in my calendar. right? So all these professors who are busy show up to meet with Lane and give him feedback, and Lane doesn't show up.
Oh my gosh.
And my PhD advisor covered for me. He made an excuse for me. Then he called me into his office. And my PhD advisor's name was Don Lehman, and I am forever grateful for him because he fit that mold of firm but fair. Never raised his voice
at me. Shout out to Don.
Yeah, he's a legend. Never raised his voice at me, never got angry, just basically gave the boundaries, gave the options, right? He said, listen, I know you've had kind of a rough year. My brother was in a car accident, almost died.
Oh, wow.
So you know you've had a rough year. The reality is you are at the best program in the world for what you want to study. There are a lot of people who would love to be in your shoes. And a PhD isn't for everybody. And we can talk about switching you to a master's. But right now, I'm telling you, you're very close to being in danger of going on probation from this program. Because I don't care how long you're in lab every day, whether it's 2 hours or 20 hours. I don't care if you fail. I don't care if you screw things up, but I do care if you give effort. I have seen that you have not been giving the effort. And I knew he was right. And I looked at him, I said, you're right, I'm going to fix it. And I just, probably is going to sound really goofy, but I put a wipe-off board in my office. This is in 2007, I want to say. And I wrote down three things every day I had to do. And it didn't matter if it took me 2 hours, 20 hours. And some of them were basically really easy, like, order reagents for this, do this, run this assay. But I got my PhD doing three things every day. Now, I could do more if I wanted to, but it was like, for some reason, just having three.
Yep.
It was like, that can't be that bad, right?
Yep.
I had this experience too in work, even in undergrad. So many times I'm like, there's no way I can get all this done. Because I'm looking at everything and then I go into spiral mode where I'm feeling overwhelmed and the world is closing in. And I still have those feelings sometimes, but I go, okay, sitting in this doesn't help me. The only way to get through it is to start chipping away. And you know what happens when I start chipping away? It's never nearly as bad as I thought.
Yeah.
Ever. And so I've gotten pretty good at not procrastinating on things. I'm pretty good at it. I usually get right into it because I know one of the things I'm like, there's no point in procrastinating because I'm just going to get distracted anyway while I'm doing it. So might as well just get started. But honestly, the thing I'm most proud of in my career is that, quite frankly, kind of what I alluded to earlier with the business getting kicked out and suing me, that was at the same time I was going through my first divorce. I just found out my son was autistic. I had injured my back and couldn't train. Wow. And for me, training is like, I'll go train 2 or 3 hours a day. Like, I train hard and that helps me. Like, that is so important for me. And my best friend Mike's been like, dude, I didn't want to believe it. He's like, but like, seeing how you are, how hyped up you are, I can't imagine what you would be like if you didn't train that way, you know? And not just hyped up. I'm just like a happier person. I always tell people, life doesn't feel so heavy when I can lift heavy, you know?
Oh, I love that.
So I'm going through this, like, I owed more money to attorneys than I can write a check for, because during the divorce, you don't have a lot of liquid funds because everything's tied up until you're finished. I'm getting slandered by these people online. I don't know what's going to happen, all that kind of stuff. But essentially, that company was making a lot of money every month, and they just said, we know Lane doesn't have the money to fight us, and we're just going to draw this out until he has to quit. I was going through a lot, and I was like, I got to generate revenue somehow again, because I had put so much effort into this company. My coaching had taken a back seat. It was hard for me to re-ramp up that coaching. I was like, well, what can I do? I can write an ebook. Okay. So I wrote my first ebook, The Complete Contest Prep Guide, which is my guide to contest prep. I wrote it in 8 weeks and it was 300 pages. And the day we launched the pre-sale was the day I had my second or third mediation with my former business partners that they walked out of. And so I made enough money from that pre-sale to fight them for one more month, kick their ass in a couple of hearings in front of the judge, and basically force them into a position where they had to settle for something fair.
Yes.
I am very proud of the fact that despite everything I was going through, I still showed up and did what was necessary to get it done, And going through that just gave me so much confidence. I'm like, you can't mess with me. I've already been to the edge. I've seen the abyss. I didn't blink, Obviously, like, I didn't like lose a limb or anything like that, but to be having like felt like my life was falling apart.
Yeah.
And to be able to get through that and then very quickly come out the other side and actually be in a much better place, like, it just gave me a lot of confidence. And then as part of that, you know, I got a silver medal at Worlds in 2015 in powerlifting. I won 2 national championships. I set a world squat record. So I competed in the 205-pound class in what's called the IPF. And I did that at 205 weight class. I squatted 668 pounds, got a gold medal in that, got a silver medal overall, and was eyeing, okay, silver medal, I'm going to win a world title. And then I started going through a bunch of injuries. And to the point where, like, I had days where I couldn't even stand up. Lower back pain. I've herniated 2 discs in my neck. I've herniated 2 discs in my lower back. I've bulged 2 discs in my lower back. I've torn muscles in both my hips. I completely tore this pec. It had to be surgically reattached. I partially tore this pec, partially tore both adductors. Am I missing anything? And some other odds and ends. There were times where I didn't even know if I was going to be able to come back. You know, they talk about high achievers and they've just got this supreme confidence. I didn't. I mean, what data would suggest to me that I'm going to be able to get through all this stuff? But I have a rule, which is I'm not allowed to give up on anything I'm passionate about. And so I said, okay, this stuff, if I don't feel deep in here that I have it in me and it's not fun anymore, then I'll stop, you know?
Yeah.
And fortunately, I worked with some really great people. I did a lot of reading about like evidence-based pain science that is, honestly, a lot of the pain stuff that's out there now is complete quackery. And if you read the evidence-based pain science, it's not what people think it is. It's not, well, you need surgery and you got to do special stretches or whatever. It's actually, you know what some of the biggest things to reduce pain and risk of injury are? Sleeping 8 hours a night. Wow. Managing your psychological stress. That's actually a big one. People with higher levels of psychological stress get injured more frequently and perceive greater levels of pain. So I worked on all this, and a year and a half ago, I won, not open worlds, but I won masters, my age class, world championships. And even going into that, I had to deal with a lot of pain flare-ups. And I was going in competing against a 3-time world champion who was pretty dominant. When you go in, they have what are called nominations, which is the amount you lifted to get into this world championship. So everybody has to win their national championship to get in. So he was nominated almost like close to 100 pounds over me. But I knew that my lifts I hit at nationals weren't my absolute top end. I knew I had some room to move, and I was still kind of coming back on the upswing. Before worlds, that's where things got really, really bad between my second wife and I. And everybody responds to that kind of stress differently. There was a lot of stress back home. I was in Newfoundland, and there was a lot of outside stuff I kind of had to deal with. It was, you know, again, my best friend Mike came to support me, and he was like, dude, I'm just so worried. You worked so hard for this. You know, I'm just worried that this is going to like take away from it. I don't know. I mean, I know why, but I just had so many moments in my life. I'm kind of like the kind of person who, when it's worse, I do better. I don't know what it is. I just looked at him. I said, man, this just means I'm going to win. And he was like, are you sure? So went out and won. And
yes.
I have a game day coach as well. His name is Ben Escrow. And he's definitely neurodivergent. No questions. Very much on the more introverted side of things.
Sure.
And we have worked together for 10 years, and he's handled me at all these big meets. And after that meet, he came up and gave me the biggest hug. And he's like, I'm so proud of you. He's like, you continue to defy the odds. He's like, I don't understand how you do this stuff.
Mm.
I'll never forget after world championships. So at my first worlds in 2015, I was nominated in 7th place. They projected me to win 7th. And actually, the head coach of the team, Matt Gary, he sent me this big list. This guy's forgotten more about powerlifting than most people know. He sent me this big, long list of everybody in my weight class, what their tendencies are, what could happen, all this kind of stuff. At the bottom, he said, you have the chance to get a medal overall, but you have to be perfect. If you miss one lift, you're going to be out. And I had never gone, so you get 3 attempts at each lift. I'd never gone 9 for 9 in my entire life. I'd always missed at least one. And that day I was perfect. I went 9 for 9 and set the world squat record. And I went up and I got drug tested. The drug testing procedure is like about an hour long because there's a lot of checks and balances they have to do to make sure that the sample collection is appropriate. And I came back down the stairs And I come back down the stairs, and Ben is still sitting where I left him. His head's in his hands, and he's crying. Sorry. I get emotional. And I'm like, dude, what is it? We did it. And he goes, how the hell did you just do that? How did you do that? You were the kid with skinny legs that everybody made fun of on the forums, and you just squatted a world record at the biggest meet in history. And I was like, I'm just kind of hard-headed. I was telling somebody the other day, I've just had really cool experiences in my life. So many like epic moments where it would be either fold up or step up. And I don't know what it is, but I've just had this, I've been able to step up. And I look now at that stuff when that stuff kind of happens. It's probably a sick part of me. It's like, cool, this thing happened. It's going to make it harder. Great, let's do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think I told Ben when he came up to Canada and like everything that was going on with, you know, me going through my divorce and everything, I had said to him, I was like, well, man, it's going to make a hell of a story. And he's like, yeah, you got a few of those. So I'd say that stuff is what I'm most proud of, because I had a lot of opportunities where I could fold it up and pack it home and nobody would have blamed me. And I never did. I kept showing up. And my mom called me. My mom's a fighter too. So my mom had multiple myeloma, which is incurable cancer. And she got diagnosed in 2014, and she is still alive and kicking and healthy.
Wow.
I remember when she was telling the family, I'm going to be blatantly honest with you, I wasn't even worried. I don't know what it was. I was just like, you know, cancer doesn't mess with the wrong woman. I can tell you that. She called me after I won Worlds last year, and her and Dad were watching my kids. You know, my daughter's screaming in the background, Daddy's a world champion! Daddy's a world champion! But my mom called me, and she was like, son, I have no idea how you just did that. Like, you're like, my parents were very intimately familiar with everything that was going on. But like, the fact that you could focus like that, and I'm like, well, maybe there's the superpower. Because, you know, one thing I can do is if I love something, I can block everything else out and completely hyperfixate on that. In some ways, it's made things hard, but in other ways, I've learned how to channel it and funnel it. And, you know, I always tell people, I think people's best and worst characteristics are right up against each other, right?
Oh, yeah, that's good.
I think one of the things that people struggle with in personal relationships is accepting somebody for the stuff that you love, that you also have to accept the stuff that you don't love, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm a big personality, and I talk a lot, and I tell great stories, and I'm funny, but I'm also going to cut you off sometimes. You know what I mean?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So this kind of push-pull of things, I've tried to lean into more of, okay, let's try not to make this part of me that's tough on others. Let's try to like manage that as best we can, while also stepping into owning that this is who I am.
For and sure.
All of the great things about me are the other side of this coin. Okay.
Yes.
And you don't get those great things without some of the crappy stuff, you know?
Totally. I wish we could just talk for hours. I know we can't. Tell us a little bit about the work that you do, because I know that you're coaching, and I'm just curious if you think that is your coaching appropriate for neurodivergent people?
Mm.
Should they go find you and figure out how they can work with you and get nutritional coaching and fitness coaching and figure out, because I think that you can be intimidating. But what I appreciate is that you've shared your story of struggle. And I feel like that is what's relatable, because everyone listening is like, I know how to struggle. I don't know if I know how to be a world champion, but I sure know how to struggle. You know? And so I so appreciate that. So tell me a little bit about your coaching and whether or not you feel like somebody listening might benefit from it.
So I don't do much one-on-one coaching anymore, just because I'm spread so thin. I just don't have time to devote to it. But I have trained like a team of people who I kind of handpicked and trained in the way we do things to coach people. It's called Team BioLane. And I would say, yes, we're for neurodivergence. I think we're pretty much for anybody who is coachable. If you are coachable, we can help you. Now, what do I mean by coachable? Well, let's take me, for example. because I would say for the first 5 years of therapy, I wasn't really coaching. Okay.
Yes.
Because I used therapy more as a tool to just vent and get out what I was frustrated about. And I didn't really listen to the things that were being said to me. And when I look back, I'm like, you know, this was coaching and I wasn't coachable. Are you willing to look in the mirror? And I would wager that if you go to real professionals who are evidence-based in any different field, you will come back with some version of the following about how to be successful in whatever it is you're looking at, which is you're going to have to be work very hard, do it for a long period of time, and be very consistent.
Yeah.
And that's the key. So I think our coaching can work for anybody as long as they are coachable. If you are willing to be accountable, then this coaching can work for you. But a lot of people hire coaches just so they have somebody to blame, whether they realize it or not. So one of the things we do, our core, if I had to, of course, we're evidence-based, we're science-based, but the X's and O's of nutrition are not difficult. They really aren't. People overcomplicate this stuff online because if they can overcomplicate it, they can sell you special programs that increase value. What we basically sell is behavior change, is how to coach behavior change. How do we get somebody to change behavior?
Yeah.
Because the X's and O's are not difficult.
Yep.
You know, for a long time, I was like, I can solve the obesity crisis. Just here, eat these calories and macros, right? And then it turns out, oh, hey, dumb, not everybody's a robot like you when it comes to this stuff, right?
Exactly.
So our core pillars are we do accountability with empathy. Looking back, I realized this is my best friends. This is the teachers and the professors I responded to best. Why? Because they acknowledged what was hard for me. They acknowledged what I did well. But then they also held me accountable for the things that I was not doing my part on.
Yep.
When I was in a space where I was coachable, that's what made the biggest difference for me. And so that's how we do things. Because if you just have empathy, then there's no impetus for change. If it's just, oh, I understand why that was so hard, but you're doing these things so well. Okay, well, great, maybe I feel better in the short term, but I'm still not going to get that other stuff done that I need to do, right? And if it's just accountability, I mean, pretty soon you're just not sharing anymore with your coach because you don't want to get browbeat anymore, right? You don't want to hear every negative thing that you're – I mean, everybody's like relating back to partners. If you're in a relationship with somebody who's really critical of you, you're just going to end up feeling very alone and shut down all the time because you just end up tuning it out. It's all you can do, right? So we do both those things. So that's kind of like the high end of what we do with our coaching. I also help develop a nutritional coaching app called Carbon Diet Coach, which, you know, for people who can't afford one-on-one coaching, this app is a great option. It's $10 a month and it does like basically tell you like, hey, eat this based on your goals and your individual metabolism and your dietary preferences.
Yeah.
And again, like, because people kind of, why would I pay for, you know, one-on-one coaching when I could get this for $10? And I would say one of the greatest parts of our coaching is we focus on connecting with clients. Because one of the fundamental aspects to get somebody to buy in is they want to make you proud. They want you to, like my best coaches, I wanted to make them proud. Most of my clients, they told me, they're like, we just didn't want to let you down. We wanted you to be proud of us, you know?
Yeah,
and I did that. I would gush over them when they did something well.
Yes.
And I would hold them accountable when they didn't do it well, right? But if you can't afford that and you just need some accountability, X's and O's, Carbon Diet Coach is great. I also do workout programs on my website on the BioLane Workout Builder, which is, again, a low monthly fee that automates a lot of this stuff for people. And then we have a research review as well. For people who are coaches, I do online courses. I have my own supplement line called Outward Nutrition. My courses are called Physique Coaching Academy. Yeah, I do it all. After I built Physique Coaching Academy, I go, this is it. We're not building anything else. That's it.
Yeah, right.
We're done.
So I love it.
That's kind of all the stuff I do. But I really tried to look at what did I need when I was starting? Yeah. What would have helped me? And then build those things out for people that now when they're starting, I can help them from A to Z.
So good. where is the best place for people to connect with you? Where should people go to find you?
So I'm BioLane on all social media. Instagram's probably my strongest platform in terms of following. And I feel like I do pretty good content on there. But I'm on YouTube, I'm on Facebook.
I can confirm. I can confirm. Thank you. Yeah. Love your Instagram content. Love just like your rage videos. Those are my favorite ones where you're just raging and you're just like, people are so stupid. And I'm like, yes, they are. I love it. Yeah, it's my favorite.
Probably a little bit of my autism as well of like, no, not your feelings. These are facts. These are absolute facts, you know? Trying to tone down my aggression a little bit. But I think I really struggle when I see people deliberately lying and misrepresenting facts, even if they're well-intentioned. You're not going to get much mercy from me when it comes to that.
Yeah.
Because I love the downstream effects of how horribly that affects people. Because it actually ends up getting people killed. Like, I'm sorry. Yeah. You're not just welcome to your opinion. Or you're welcome to your opinion. You are. You're also welcome to have me come in and tell you what an idiot you are. So there's that.
Yes,
for people out there, I do a lot of debunking content. I really try to simplify things because most of these people who are spreading misinformation, they are trying to overcomplicate stuff so that they can sell you something. They're trying to make you afraid.
Always.
They're trying to instill fear in you because it's a very visceral emotional response so that you'll buy stuff. I do a lot of debunking content to just try to simplify things for people to remove that anxiety so they can actually do the stuff that gets them to like be better.
So good. It's the Lord's work, really, if we're being honest. You're doing the Lord's work.
Thank you.
I love it.
I'm not perfect and I screwed up a lot of things and I've hurt people in my life and I try to get it right and I try to make a net positive benefit to the world. So
it's good. Thanks so much for being here. It's been really fun. Appreciate it. Appreciate your vulnerability and just your willingness to share your story.
Sure. And if I can speak real quick to any young ADHD people listening, what makes you weird and the stuff you get made fun of is going to make you great if you lean into it. Okay. I was talkative. I was loud. I was passionate. All that stuff was why I got bullied when I was young. And it's why I've been so good at what I do now. So don't hide those parts of you. Figure out a way to have them flourish.
Yes. Applause. Love it. Appreciate you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Christy.
A few years ago, I went looking for help. I wanted to find someone to teach me how to feel better about myself and to help me improve my organization, productivity, time management, emotional regulation. You know, all the things that we adults with ADHD struggle with. But I couldn't find anything. So I researched and I studied and I hired coaches and I figured it out. And then I created Focused for you. Focused is my monthly coaching membership where I teach educated professional adults how to accept their ADHD brain and hijack their ability to get stuff done. Hundreds of people from all over the world are already benefiting from this program and I'm confident that you will too. Go to iHaveADHD.com/focused for all details.